If you have indigestion, do you reach for Zantac or for Nexium? Lots of people do. When should you see a doctor? This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
A bad bellyache can really get your attention. When should you seek medical attention?
Everybody over 50 needs to be screened for colon cancer. What's the best method? Colonoscopy or something else like Cologuard? What are the pros and cons?
Which digestive tract symptoms are alarming? And which ones can you manage at home? What are the most common problems and which ones are most serious? Find out what to do.
Coming up on the People's Pharmacy, your calls and questions about digestive tract distress.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, people who consume a lot of soft drinks may be putting themselves at risk. The EPIC study in several European countries included nearly 500,000 people, followed up for an average of 16 years. All the participants filled out detailed dietary and lifestyle questionnaires at the beginning of the study. By the end of the research period, the investigators found that those who reported consuming two or more glasses of soft drinks daily were about 17% more likely to have died than those who drank less than one glass monthly. In particular, soft drink guzzlers were more susceptible to cardiovascular disease and digestive problems. They were also more likely to die of Parkinson's disease. In general, artificially sweetened soft drinks were not safer than sugar-sweetened sodas. Such epidemiological research can't establish cause and effect. The authors were careful to describe this as an association. Even so, limiting soft drink consumption is a step that nutrition experts and public health authorities have been advocating for years.
There's good news and bad news when it comes to moderate alcohol consumption. A study presented at a meeting of the American College of Cardiology suggests that people who drink alcoholic beverages are more likely to have high blood pressure. This risk has long been recognized for heavy drinkers. The current study is the first to establish that people consuming one to two drinks a day may also be at greater risk for hypertension. On the other hand, a different study of more than 100,000 health professionals for over two decades found that low to moderate alcohol consumption was linked to a lower risk of hip fractures. Women who preferred red wine appeared to be at the lowest risk. Neither study can prove a cause and effect relationship.
Tramadol has become one of the most widely prescribed pain relievers in the U.S. That's because many doctors have become reluctant to prescribe opioids like oxycodone. Tramadol exerts a mild effect upon opioid receptors. It also affects neurotransmitters such as serotonin and norepinephrine. A new analysis of FDA's adverse event reporting system reveals an association between tramadol and episodes of low blood sugar. Hypoglycemia is characterized by symptoms such as dizziness, shakiness, sweating, fatigue, anxiety, nausea, confusion, blurred vision, and fainting. No one should ever stop tramadol suddenly, as that could lead to serious withdrawal symptoms.
When most people think about probiotics, they focus on digestive tract problems. But a new analysis suggests that people who take probiotics are less likely to lose work time from flu-like illness. The economic analysis was based upon two different meta-analyses. They concluded that the use of probiotics was also linked to fewer upper respiratory tract infections, fewer doctor visits, and a lower use of antibiotics. The authors estimated the savings to the U.S. economy at over $1 billion.
By now, it should come as no surprise that dietary choices can affect health. A new British study of more than 48,000 people compared meat eaters, vegetarians, and fish eaters, also termed pescatarians. Over the course of 18 years, some of these people experienced coronary heart disease or stroke. Analysis showed that meat eaters had a higher risk of heart disease, with approximately 10 fewer cases per 1,000 people over 10 years among vegetarians. Perhaps this is because vegetarians tend to have lower blood pressure and cholesterol levels. On the other hand, vegetarians and vegans were more likely to suffer strokes, with roughly 3 more cases per 1,000 people over 10 years. Fish eaters also had a higher risk of stroke than meat eaters, but the difference was not significant. An accompanying editorial warns that these findings from British vegetarians might not apply to most of the world's vegetarians who live primarily in low-income countries. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon. I'm a pharmacologist.
I'm Terry Graydon. I'm a medical anthropologist. Have you ever had a bad bellyache? What did you do about it? Diagnosing the cause of your own abdominal pain is a risky business, but you can't go to the emergency department every time your stomach hurts. How do you tell the difference between heartburn and a heart attack? Gas and a gallbladder attack? Irritable bowel syndrome, and appendicitis.
To help us answer those questions and a whole lot more, we turn to Dr. Nicholas Shaheen. He's the Bozemski-Heiser Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. He's also chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at UNC. Dr. Shaheen is a recognized expert in esophageal disease and endoscopy. He's author of multiple treatment guidelines for gastrointestinal illnesses. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Nick Shaheen.
Thanks, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here. Good to see you again, too, Terry.
And you. And we want to answer all those questions, but we're going to take them in order, as it were. And we're going to start with the upper GI problems and work our way down from top to bottom. How do people tell the difference between heartburn and a heart attack?
It's a terrific question, and it's not a trivial thing. I've had people come to see me in my clinic for care for their heartburn, and not to be overly dramatic, but even people have coronary events while waiting in the GI clinic. It happens because these are commonly confused symptoms that are hard to parse out. And in fact, atypical presentations of coronary disease commonly include GI symptoms. So,
like?
Heartburn.
Oh, okay.
And certainly chest pain, abdominal pain, very common depending on where issues are in the heart. That can be a manifestation. So, absolutely, this is a worthy question. And I guess there's a few things to think about. First of all, an important one is chronicity, meaning that, oh gosh, every time after I eat pizza, I get this burning under my breastbone, and it's happened to me for the last 7 years. That's much more likely to be classic reflux. Now, 20% of the U.S. population suffers reflux on a weekly basis. So this kind of—
Whoa, 20%? One out of five?
Yes, one out of five. So—
this, how come?
Yeah. Well—
That seems like an awful lot of people.
So you walk outside and you look around and you realize we have an epidemic of obesity.
And that makes it more common.
It makes it more common. You're getting increased intra-abdominal pressure. You're getting the stomach being pushed up into the chest. And you're starting to have lots of contents coming up from the stomach into the chest. So it's really a problematic thing, and it's becoming more common. Also, there are certain foods that we can talk about that predispose you to this, which unfortunately we seem to eat in abundance. Fatty food tends to stay in your stomach longer. Things like chocolate, peppermint decrease the tone of that ring at the bottom of your esophagus and can promote reflux. Acidic things, classically, are going to potentially promote reflux as well, or at least promote irritation. So a good rule of thumb is if you're enjoying it a lot, chances are it's inducing reflux.
So what you're saying is if every Thursday you go out for pizza— And by
every Thursday night you feel bad,
then it's probably not a heart attack.
But probably not going to be a heart attack.
Probably some other discrimination you can make as well.
Right. It doesn't mean you're in the clear, and it doesn't mean you're not doing bad things to your body. But the good news is that we tend to judge things by the company they keep. That's what my professors used to tell me, meaning that if we see somebody with carrying a fair bit of weight who's having this classic burning. Now, one thing I think it's important to distinguish is that we relatively indiscriminately call any ache between our chin and our knees heartburn. Mm-hmm. So understand what heartburn is and what heartburn isn't. A burning or warmth that rises from the bottom of your breastbone up toward your chin is classic heartburn. Okay. And that's a symptom that almost always is going to be associated with a reflux event. It's not crushing substernal chest pain. That's not heartburn. It's not a burning in your mouth or behind the back of your throat. That's not heartburn. Those certainly could be manifestations of reflux, but that's not heartburn.
So if somebody starts to complain in your clinic and you begin to go, this might not be reflux, I maybe need to get them to the cardiac care unit. What would be a tip off to you that maybe this is not something benign?
Well, paradoxically, one of the most common tests ordered in my clinic is a treadmill stress test for hearts. What do we look at? We look at their cardiac risk factors. We look at the onset, the timing of the onset of those symptoms. I get a lot of heartburn when I walk or when I exercise. Ding, 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 ding.
Okay, that's so that's maybe not heartburn.
Right. And that's where we need to think a little bit more. Gosh, my stomach is flat as a washboard, and I don't have that habitus, and I don't have the usual triggers that we were just talking about in foods, but I'm getting now heartburn, especially in a woman. Atypical manifestations of heart disease more common in women.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start seeing this constellation, you say, well, let's slow down. Let's take a step back. We may have a problem here.
We've also heard that women sometimes experience nausea or something of that, which seems gastrointestinal, but could actually be a symptom of a heart attack.
Absolutely. Atypical manifestations of heart disease are something that we really have to be on the lookout for.
Have you ever suffered heartburn? Have you been diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus? What have you been told to do about it? Dr. Nicola Shaheen is here to answer your questions. Our lines are open at 888-472-3366. You can email us, radio@peoplespharmacy.com. The number again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-472-3366. Now, Dr. Shaheen, one of the big questions that I think people have a hard time dealing with is, should I go see the doctor for this nausea, heartburn, whatever you want to call it, this thing that's going on? I got a bad bellyache. Now, I have to admit, this is sort of a bit of a conflict of interest, but I asked you that question. Actually, Terry asked you that question, and you probably saved my life.
Just about just a little more than a year ago,
We had come back on an airplane from San Francisco. The whole plane ride was a disaster for me because I had the worst bellyache of my life. On a scale of 1 to 10, it was about an 8. I even contemplated asking the pilot to land the plane. It was that bad. But I thought, oh, all these people are going to be so mad at me. I can't do that.
I don't understand why, when I asked you if we should go straight to the emergency room, you said no.
Well, I thought maybe if I just lie down, if I just go home and get into bed, I'll feel better. But I said, maybe you should call Dr. Shaheen first.
So we got in touch, and you were kind enough to call back, and you said, yes, go to the emergency room.
I remember that well.
That probably, it might have saved his life.
Well, it turned out that I had something very weird called intussusception. I won't ask you to spell that. But basically, my small intestine had migrated into my large intestine. Happens to kids, not so often to adults. It required emergency surgery. And if it hadn't happened the way it did, if I hadn't had that surgery, what could have resulted?
Yeah, that's a dangerous situation. What you had, it actually is quite rare in adults, but you essentially had intestinal obstruction. And unfortunately, your body can only go on for a limited time with intestinal obstruction, and the intestine may perforate or get a hole in it. The insides of your body cavity are sterile, even though your GI tract isn't. So essentially, that bacteria would have spilled out into the sterile cavity and created a very serious situation. So the fact that things worked out as they did were quite good.
So thank you very much. It's nice to be here. Let's go to line one, Ithaca, New York. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. Robert, what's your question about GERD?
Hi. So I have frequent heartburn, and I had an endoscopy done, and I have a hiatal hernia. And so my natural, I went on omeprazole, which you're probably well familiar with. It's probably the most prescribed drugs in the United States. The problem with once you go on omeprazole, you cannot go off it. It is very, very difficult to wean yourself off.
Robert, we're coming up on a break. Could you get to your question as quickly as possible, please?
Yeah, I'm trying to manage, heartburn by not using drugs, by actually, essentially using sodium bicarbonate and things like that. Is that effective? Is there a downside?
Oh, right. Thanks for that question, Robert. Dr. Shaheen, is it reasonable for Robert to manage his heartburn from a hiatal hernia without omeprazole?
Great question, Robert. And two things we should unpack there. First of all, what's a hiatal hernia?
Yeah, what is that?
Hiatal hernia is an incredibly common condition. It's a little piece of your stomach that has pulled up into your chest, allowing easier access of that acid up into your chest, which is what really reflux really is. So you're absolutely right, Robert. That's a predisposing condition to the symptoms you're having. Now, whether or not something like sodium bicarbonate is a logical way to manage it depends on several issues. Number one, the severity and chronicity of those symptoms. Unfortunately, sodium bicarbonate only hangs around for a few minutes, so it could be fine for relatively mild reflux. If you're having it on a several times a week basis and relatively severe, it's probably going to be inadequate to address your problems.
Well, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to ask you about diet. Because there is some research that suggests a low-carb diet may be beneficial against reflux.
After the break, we'll take more of your calls and hear your stories about digestive distress.
Just how do you tell the difference between gas and a bad gallbladder attack?
Give us a call and share your thoughts and stories about your gastrointestinal misadventures.
Our lines are open at 888-472-3366. If the lines are full, email us, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Verizana, an analytical laboratory providing home health tests for hormones, gut health, and the microbiome. Online at verisana.com.
And by Cocavia, maker of high-potency cocoflavanol supplements that support cognitive and cardiovascular health. More information at COCAVIA, that's C-O-C-O-A, VIA.com.
Today, we're learning what to do about digestive distress. Our guest is Dr. Nicholas Shaheen, the Bozimsky Heiser Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and Chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at UNC.
We invite you to join the conversation. Have you had trouble with your gallbladder? Have you had stomach ulcers or been treated for Helicobacter pylori? Our lines are open at 888-472-3366. Email us, radio@peoplespharmacy.com. We're at People's Pharmacy on Twitter.
And we go to Dallas, Texas. Joshua, welcome to the People's Pharmacy. Your question.
Hello. My question is, what are the dangers of taking heartburn medications such as Prilosec? In the long-term sense, not necessarily over just a couple of days, but maybe over a couple of years.
Thanks for that, Joshua. Dr. Shaheen, this is a controversial question. There has been a lot of research on both sides of it. As a gastroenterologist, of course, you love PPIs.
Love may be a strong word.
Like.
Often use. I'll take that. It's a great question. And with such a high proportion of the U.S. population on these medicines, somewhere between 7 and 10% of Americans, think about that for a second. You walk outside right now, 1 in 10 of these folks is going to be on these medicines. So their safety is clearly an important issue. We've known for – first thing I'll say is that no drug is without side effects, and this includes the PPI.
Well, let me just hop on this – my bandwagon here. I liked the idea – of H2 antagonist drugs like Tagamet, you know, cimetidine and ranitidine and Zantac. And I even thought, okay.
That was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago, that, you know, when they became available over the counter. I even liked the idea of NSAIDs, you know, drugs like ibuprofen and naproxen being available when a doctor prescribed them. But when they became available over the counter and people could play doctor, you know, oh, my arthritis is acting up. I could take this for weeks, months, years. As a gastroenterologist, you know the consequences of long-term, high-dose NSAID use. And so it's like, well, what about PPIs? Because, now they're available. Now I can play doctor.
Now
I
you can take both NSAIDs and PPIs, yes, and you probably will.
So my concern is that people can literally take these drugs for years without any medical supervision.
That's true. Now, if you're taking them over the counter and taking them as per the package, the FDA has tried to limit that. They say, listen, if you're going to be taking these for more than 14 days, you need to be talking to your physician about that's what they're supposed to be used for. Now, we know that people commonly will take this for many multiples of that. The drugs, when they first came out, I remember this like it was yesterday. We were, because they're very, very active in terms of suppressing acid, we were, boy, this is going to mess up basic biology. There's going to be some big problems with these drugs. And they initially came with what's called a black box warning, meaning, gosh, we don't know what this really does, but it can't be good for that long, you know, to do this for a long time, to suppress the normal production of acid for that long. With time and over the years, these drugs, as you know, have now been available or used, at least in certain parts of the world, for in excess of 30 years. We have gained a lot of experience with it. Certain things are reliable side effects of these drugs. People can develop diarrhea, for instance. Some people develop abdominal pain to these drugs. Those are clearly what we call class effects. All of those drugs have done that. More recently, there's been this litany of hundreds, literally, of different problems that have been putatively associated with these drugs.
Such as?
You name it. Coronary artery disease, literally tooth decay. Kidney problems for sure. C. diff infection, a bacterial infection of the colon. Community-acquired pneumonia. The list is literally as long as my arm. Some of these may be true. What your listeners need to know about them is this. The associations are just that. They're associations. There aren't data to show causality. And the associations are actually relatively weak. They're usually database studies with usually very marginally increased risks. So the short answer is, if you really need to be on these medicines and a doctor has told you to be on these medicines for a good indication, it's highly likely that the benefits to you outweigh the risks.
Now, I promised we were going to talk about diet and GERD.
let's talk about diet and GERD. Everybody wants to know, what should I avoid to avoid GERD? And there are a couple things I'll tell you. It's not just the food stuffs. It's the time of day you eat them.
Oh.
America has become the Barca Lounger society, right? We watch way too much TV. We eat and then we lay flat or recumbent or recline. It's a very, very common thing.
Not a good idea.
Not a good idea. You want gravity to help you when you have reflux.
So you want to be taking your postprandial walk.
Thank you. Yes. You want to be doing something that moves things through your GI tract. Ingesting a big high-fat meal and laying on the couch and watching what's on tonight is a recipe for reflux. It's even worse if what you happened to eat was high in fats, if you took alcohol with it, because that reduces the tone of the ring at the bottom of the esophagus, if you had certainly spicy type things that are going to be potentially irritating to the inner lining of the esophagus, certain acidic foods like tomato sauces, orange juice, and the like will also promote this. So unfortunately, a lot of what we really enjoy is not so good for us.
And the carb story, because there was a study, and I think you might have even participated in it, that suggested cutting back on carbs might make a difference.
Yeah, we had this observation that our folks that went on Atkins diets, and I'm not promoting any certain diet here beyond a healthy diet, but folks who did go on Atkins diets had a remarkable and almost immediate decrease in their GERD symptoms.
Even before they lost weight.
Even before they lost weight. And I said, gosh, isn't that interesting? Because we're always looking, you know, for better ways to counsel our patients. So we did a study, and indeed we found out that these patients actually do have an improvement. Now, we still haven't wrapped our hands around what that really means and what's really important in that diet not in that diet, perhaps, that's making that difference. But yeah, it's an interesting observation, isn't it?
Let's go back to the phones, Terry.
Yes, we're going to talk to Efrain in Pittsboro, North Carolina. Efrain, welcome to the People's Pharmacy. Your question.
Thank you. Hi, y'all. I'm 84. I have been on omeprazole and every other thing. Once upon a time, I lived on nothing but Maalox. Now I take Gaviscon. I'm trying to wean myself off of omeprazole. I don't know how I can do that. If I stop, I'll immediately start to GERD and so on. So I'm just wondering. I maintain a very good diet. I live healthy. I'm lacking exercise, but everything else I do. Is there some way I can find a way to get off? I find myself hiccuping a lot if I try to stop taking the drug.
Okay, we're going to ask Dr. Shaheen. Dr. Shaheen. Getting off omeprazole. It's not as easy as just stopping.
No, because there's this thing called rebound hyperacidity.
That's exactly right. And if you were a drug company inventing a pill for the first time, in terms of profitability, you could not do much better than a proton pump inhibitor. Understand what these medicines are doing for you and what they're not doing for you. What a proton pump inhibitor does is decreases the amount of acid your stomach is making. Okay. It doesn't stop reflux. It just means that the stuff that's coming up in your chest is less like car battery acid, less corrosive, and more like water. So your reflux is still occurring despite the proton pump inhibitor. Now imagine that you want to get off. Well, two nasty things happen simultaneously. The first is the stomach lining, which has been suppressed for all this time and wanting to do its primary job in life, which is make acid, all of a sudden is free to the tyranny of the drug. And it's going to make acid. And it actually not only makes acid, it makes acid in abundance. It actually overshoots the amount of acid that you need, the so-called phenomenon of hypersecretion. So you're worse off than when you started. Now, the good news about that is this. That hypersecretion goes down over about 3 days. So if you can tolerate kind of getting through that period where your body is re-equilibrating, you're going to do better. The bad news is that you haven't changed the basic problem. These drugs decrease the acid secretion, so you can expect reliably, unless you've made other changes, i.e. lost weight, i.e. changed your diet, getting more exercise, the other things that we know will help reflux, you can pretty reliably expect those symptoms to come back. Maybe a week, maybe a month, but they're going to come back.
Now, there's one other little piece to this, and it's the anatomy that you love. It's called the lower esophageal sphincter. It's that little, what do you want to call it, flap? It's right. muscular, and it keeps stuff, or it's supposed to, where it belongs, down in the stomach and not back in your food tube, the esophagus. There are some drugs that relax. You said alcohol does it, but Ambien, you know, Zolpidem, a sleeping pill can do it. Diazepam, Valium can do it. And we've heard that Sildenafil, Viagra, and maybe some of the other Viagra-like drugs can do it. So if somebody is experiencing heartburn after Viagra, maybe they need to plan ahead.
Well, hopefully it was worthwhile.
Let's definitely hope so.
So you're absolutely right. This is an amazing little piece of anatomy, and it's a really smart little muscular band. And the idea behind this is that it's supposed to relax to let the food go down and then tighten up immediately afterward and actually become even tighter right after you've eaten to keep reflux from coming up. And it actually does a remarkably good job of it. But you're right. It can decrease in its tone from all of the entities that you just mentioned, the pharmacologic entities, as well as a few couple others that your listeners should know about. Beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, a lot of things that people take for their hearts are also going to
nitroglycerin,
decrease tone.
Perhaps?
Nitroglycerin. Yeah. So people should know about that.
While we're still on the topic of reflux and what makes it more common, let's go back to the phones. Rich in Tampa, welcome to the People's Pharmacy. Your question.
Thank you. I suffered from heartburn for many years, and I was a heavy smoker for many years. I quit smoking 13 years ago, and in doing so, it was almost simultaneous that the heartburn also disappeared. And I was just wondering if there was any connection with that.
Well, first
Thanks
of
for
all,
that question.
Rich, congratulations on quitting smoking. It's the probably number one thing you can do for your health next to good food and exercise. What about this idea of smoking and reflux?
Terrific question, Rich. And your observation is spot on. You're not the only person that has had that experience. We talk a lot about keeping that reflux out of your chest, which is really important, a lot of the entities we talk about. What we haven't talked about is how good your esophageal lining is at protecting itself. And what you've done by stopping smoking is you've made your barrier more effective. It turns out that the contents of the stuff you're swallowing when you're smoking is very offensive to the inner lining of your esophagus as well and predisposes it to damage when the acid has come up. So your tissues are healthier now. And they're, even if you're having acid come up, you're more likely not to be bothered by that or to have inflammation from that. There's a constant war going on in your esophagus, and you've just helped the good guys because you've actually made the lining more resistant to inflammation.
888-472-3366 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation with Dr. Nick Shaheen. He's here for your questions. You can also email us, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
And we have an email from Mary. She says, my husband was recently diagnosed with eosinophilic esophagitis. It causes throat restriction and a host of other symptoms. The treatment is stretching the esophagus and playing hit and miss with avoiding foods and daily medication. Apparently, the doctor said it's really almost impossible to figure out what allergy is causing the reaction. My husband has had both blood and skin test allergy testing done. The results contradicted each other. The doctor prescribed 80 milligrams of a PPI, we don't know which one, for the rest of his life. Eosinophilic esophagitis. What is it? How common? And what do you do about it?
Big word, Terry. Sounds scary.
Oh, yeah.
But actually becoming more and more common all the time, and for reasons that aren't entirely clear to us. So let's talk real briefly about what it is. What it is it's an allergic reaction of the inner lining of the esophagus. And as your listener indicates, it can be to multiple different, we generally think, foodstuffs, but other environmental issues as well. With time can cause narrowing of the esophagus. One thing that's not quite correct there is that there are more treatments than just stretching the esophagus. In fact, the primary treatment we use for this is having the patient drink a steroid solution that coats the inside of the esophagus to decrease inflammation. And that's highly effective. This is not going to kill your husband, Mary. It's not going to shorten his life. It is something that he needs to take care of. The general way of this is that after folks do get a stretching and get on the appropriate medication, they eat very well. But this is becoming more and more common. It's clearly there's something in our environment.
And it's kind of new, not that it's new, but it's just that there's a lot more of it today than there was 20 years ago.
That's right, Joe. And we're not really sure why. Part of it, at least, is us not being smart enough 20 years ago. When I look down in people's esophagus and see what today is obvious EOE to me, it wasn't so obvious back then. You see what your mind sees, not what your eye sees.
Let me ask you about another condition that's kind of unusual, but maybe a little more common than people realize. There's a drug called lisinopril. It belongs to a category called ACE inhibitors, the number one most prescribed drug in this country for high blood pressure, and maybe the number one drug, period. There's this side effect associated with lisinopril, besides the cough that people often complain about, swollen lips, swollen tongue, and swollen throat, to the point where it's an emergency. They have to get to the emergency department immediately or else they can't breathe. But it can also happen, this thing called angioedema in the digestive tract, abdominal angioedema, and that can lead to blockage. Can you tell us about that and how hard it is to diagnose?
Incredibly hard to diagnose. So what this is a swelling of the intestines, which can lead to pain and rarely even to obstruction, the situation we were talking about before. When you get started on one of these drugs, any drug that ends in a pril, you're at some risk of having this reaction, this angioedema. Almost always it presents as kind of the swelling of the lips and mouth, perhaps some difficulty breathing. That's a common thing that ER doctors will all recognize. What you're talking about is a much rarer thing. So first of all, if you've been on this for 10 years, you don't have to have a lot of trepidation about this. The likelihood that you're going to get this is small. On the other hand, if you've newly started one of these drugs and you're starting to get some of these symptoms that you never had before, abdominal pain, changes in bowel habits, perhaps diarrhea, it's worth mentioning. Because that may be what's going on.
Significant pain.
Absolutely. Abdominal pain is one of the most common ones. So it doesn't happen a ton, but bad if it happens, and something that you should know about. That in fact, doctors are not as good as recognizing as we should be.
Well, it's almost time for our break. We're going to move down the digestive tract after the break and talk about gas and appendicitis, floating poop, and colonoscopies.
Pain on the left side or the right side? What are the different causes?
Does pain on the right mean appendicitis? What other symptoms should you be alert for?
Our lines are open, 888-472-3366. Dr. Shaheen is standing by for your questions. Email us, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by CocoVia, offering plant-based nutrients in the form of cocoa flavanols for brain and heart health. Online at CocoVia.com.
And by Kaya Biotics, probiotic products made in Germany from certified organic ingredients. K-A-Y-A Biotics.com.
We're talking today about the digestive tract. In this segment, we're going to focus mostly on the lower part. You know, things like colitis, appendicitis, colonoscopy, hemorrhoids, diverticulitis, floating poop, and gas.
Our guest is Dr. Nicholas Shaheen. That's S-H-A-H-E-E-N. He's the Bozimski Heiser Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and Chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at UNC. Dr. Shaheen is a recognized expert in esophageal diseases and endoscopy. And, you know, before we go back to the phone lines, you are, you know, considered by many the go-to gastroenterologist for esophageal issues. So when people have Barrett's esophagus or something worse, you have a treatment. You've kind of been the point person for this radio frequency ablation therapy. Could you give us a very quick summary of what that is and how well it's working and anything new on that horizon?
Absolutely. So the problem, one of the many problems with reflux is that with time and continued irritation from the acid coming up, you develop precancerous changes in the esophagus. And esophageal cancer is increasing dramatically in this country, 500 to 600% increase since the 1970s.
Yikes. And it's a killer, or it can be.
It's a terrible cancer to have, five-year mortality greater than 80%. So this is a highly lethal cancer. In those folks who have developed these precancerous changes because of the ongoing reflux, we used to have very few bullets in our gun to get rid of the problem. Essentially, the only thing we had for them was esophagectomy or surgical removal of the esophagus. That's a difficult thing to go through, and many patients have complications from that. And it's somewhat intellectually dissatisfying to think that we're taking out this whole organ in your body just to get rid of that inner lining. So at our center, as well as several other centers in the country, we started to work on new technologies that perhaps would cause just that inner lining to be fixed as opposed to removing the entire organ. And this procedure that you're mentioning, radiofrequency ablation, is in that group. And the basic idea is we're going to destroy those precancerous cells with high radiofrequency waves that we deliver via endoscopy. We're not taking that organ out of your body. We're just going to go through your mouth. We're going to go where those precancerous cells are. We're going to kill them. Okay. And lo and behold, and frankly, we didn't know what was going to happen. We started working on this. Healthy tissue grows back in. And when that healthy tissue grows back in, those patients' chances of developing cancer in that area go down by greater than 90%. So not perfect, but pretty darn good. And in the vast majority of our patients, allows them to eat normally and leave their esophagus in place. So this has become the standard treatment for hundreds of thousands of folks across the country, and it's actually fairly common now.
And congratulations, because you were the leader in this area.
Well, certainly big team science project. We did have a lot of we were fortunate enough to be involved with this early, and it's gratifying to see that we have better treatments for folks.
Well, Dr. Shaheen is here to answer your questions. Do you pass gas? Who doesn't? What should you do about it, if anything? Give us a call with your questions or your story. Our lines are open at 888-472-3366, and you can send us email to radio@peoplespharmacy.com. And we go to the phones, Joe. Christopher in Springfield, Missouri, welcome to the People's Pharmacy. Your question, please.
Thank you for taking my call. And Joe, you and I have talked once before about our shared experience of abdominal issues that turned into life-threatening matters. My question is, or comment to start with, I had colitis and had gone to the emergency room thinking I had colitis, and it turned out I had acute appendicitis, which ended up rupturing, and they had to take that as well as part of my colon out.
Yikes.
And after that, I had to have my gallbladder taken out as well. But what I've noticed is that since those surgeries, I'm having an increased issue of when I'm sleeping, I start, I don't know if it's vomit or acid reflux, but it will wake me up and I start choking to where I can't breathe for a good 5 minutes. And I'm wondering if there's any kind of correlation between the surgeries and the conditions that I had, and what is the best thing to do.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Christopher. Dr. Shaheen.
So, Christopher, you may be experiencing what we call nocturnal reflux. And all it means is essentially that at night you're especially prone to have these symptoms because you're laying flat, you're getting a somewhat of a relaxation of that ring that we've been talking about. Your esophagus is not quite as good at pushing things back down into the stomach as it is during the day. So it's a very common time for people to experience what you're experiencing. And you're probably having intermittent reflux. Whether or not it's associated with the previous surgeries, etc., I can't tell you for sure. It'd be a little, it's probably true and unrelated. That'd be the most common thing. So what can you do? Well, what can you do? You can elevate the head of your bed. Use gravity to help you. And you say, well, how do I do that? Well, there's a couple ways you can do that. A wedge pillow will do that for you. You could also, if it's low tech, but it works, you can put a couple of bricks under the head of your bed, so under those legs at the head of your bed to tilt your bed. If you do that, you're going to keep things in the stomach more and you're going to have less of those events that wake you up at night. There's also pharmacological interventions. You certainly could be prescribed medicine. You probably want to talk to your doctor about that.
Now, Dr. Shaheen, Christopher mentioned appendicitis. And appendicitis definitely is a big deal. How do you tell if your belly pain is appendicitis?
Right. Common cause of belly pain and one that you don't want to ignore because what happened to Christopher, unfortunately, is a potential common complication if you do ignore it too long. The appendix, you've heard of people saying, I had a burst appendix.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is essentially true. If this thing can rupture in your abdomen.
What is the appendix?
Yeah. The appendix is a little hook-like organ that hangs off the end of your colon that is mostly immunologic tissue. It's mostly lymphoid tissue. And it's got a little hole that travels in the middle of it. It's got what we call a lumen that can become obstructed. Usually with a little ball of stool or something like that. Fluids build up behind that obstruction can become infected, causing the appendix to swell. If that does do that, that potentially can be a surgical emergency. And in fact, our surgeons will take such patients, people that we have concern about, to the ORs early. And they're willing to accept the fact that sometimes they get it wrong. They got it wrong in my son. I was still happy that they took him to the OR because the potential complications of not getting a hot appendix out in a timely fashion are pretty catastrophic.
Now, we've been told for years that it's like a vestigial organ. In other words, it doesn't do anything. And now more recently, we're being told, but no, wait.
Actually, it might have a function. You could still get by without it, but it may very well have a function.
Absolutely. And it's like most things. If you wait long enough, the pendulum will swing back the other way. So it is clear that you can live without it. People do fine without it. And if it needs to come out, it needs to come out. On the other hand, the best amount of surgery to have, unless you absolutely need it, is no surgery. So certainly this idea that if you're in there anyway, just yank the thing out so it won't cause any problems, that probably is becoming a bit passe.
The idea that it might be a reservoir for bacteria that you need, it's kind of a reboot. For the colon?
Right. And it may be, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk a little bit more about this issue, the microbiome later.
Running out of time. We're going to have to start pedaling. Terry, what you got?
Well, I have a question from somebody in Beaufort, South Carolina, who says, doing yard cleanup after Hurricane Dorian, I became overheated and developed lower abdominal cramps. Before long, I was in the bathroom with vomiting and diarrhea. No fun. Is this a common heat response? So vomiting, diarrhea, when do you need to seek medical care?
Absolutely. These can be manifestations of overheating. Your GI tract is very susceptible to that. So certainly in the context with which it's described, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if essentially this is a heat reaction. Your system is very very commonly that's an issue. It's also true that there's a wide variety of normal when it comes to things like bowel movements. And it's not unusual to have isolated loose bowel movements. For instance, you know, well, I had diarrhea yesterday, but I'm okay today. And that's something that's probably okay to ignore.
Left, right.
Yeah.
I mean, and we have to start moving because we're almost out of time. But
yeah.
But how would you know if you had appendicitis, as a for example? Is the pain on the right? Is the pain on the left? Are there some?
I have to say, I think that is not as helpful when you are actually experiencing the pain as I thought it would be. I did have appendicitis about, 10 years ago, almost.
Where was your initial pain, dear?
Right around my belly button.
Thank you. That's what I was hoping you would say, because that's actually right. So this is what you need to know about the pain that comes with appendicitis. If it localizes, what you hear classically is it's in the lower part of your right abdomen, because that's where the appendix is.
Yeah, and that's what I'd always heard. And I said, no, this can't be appendicitis. No, we don't need to go to the emergency room. It can't be appendicitis. It's a bellyache. It's right around my belly button. I'll get better in a little while.
Your observation's actually correct. Before the...
Except I was wrong about not going to the emergency room.
Yeah, that was bad. But the fact that the pain was what we call periumbilical around the belly button is actually very common. Before the pancreas gets completely inflamed and is irritating the lining down on the right side, it swells and it expands. And any expanding tissue in your abdomen is going to manifest as pain around your belly button.
Now, you said the pancreas, but you meant the appendix.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, the appendix. So it's blocked, it's expanding, and it's going to transfer that pain to around the umbilicus. So that is an early warning sign. In fact, once it localizes the right lower quadrant, you ain't got that much time left. You need to hightail it in.
You better move fast.
Right.
We are running out of time. Speaking of time,
we have to talk about colonoscopy. Mm. We would be irresponsible to do a GI show and not talk about colonoscopy. What is it? Who needs it? How often? And are there alternatives?
Thank you, Terry. The message for today, if there's a message I can leave your listeners with, is get screened with colon cancer. We'll talk about the various methods, but I don't want to leave here today. A third of eligible Americans are not screened for this preventable cancer. So you can use stool cards. We're going to talk about Cologuard. You can use colonoscopy. I'm relatively agnostic, but don't die of a preventable cancer.
So let's start with something easy. FIT.
So this is an immunological test of the stool. It's essentially a test that's done on the stool to assess for blood in the stool.
Fecal immunochemical test.
Exactly. And it's a simple idea. All we're looking for is traces of blood in the stool that might indicate that there's a growth in the colon.
How good is it?
It's good. I'm going to make a plug later for colonoscopy because it's quite good at visualizing the inner lining of the colon. But FIT is good. And if that's what you and your primary care doc have chosen to do, FIT saves lives.
And you need a prescription?
Your primary care doc will give you appropriate timing for that and give you direction.
And all you need is a stool sample.
All you need is a stool sample.
Okay, we see the commercials for Cologuard all the time. It looks so simple.
And this one is also a stool sample, isn't
it? It's also a stool sample. It's somewhat more sophisticated because in addition for looking, having the immunotest in it, which it does, it also looks for DNA in the stool that may be suggestive of a colonic growth. So it's a little bit more accurate than the FIT alone. And it, too, is a stool test. It also needs to be repeated on intervals that your primary care doctor will direct. And it also is a very worthy thing to think about.
So, first step, if either of those tests, the FIT or the Cologuard, come up positive, now you need to make an appointment.
Right. So, colonoscopy could be a primary screening measure, meaning that once every 10 years you get looked at to make sure that you don't have polyps, or it can be done in follow-up to either of the tests that we just discussed.
But don't ignore getting tested.
Absolutely not. And that's the message for today. There are people whose lives are being saved. You don't die of this cancer. There's so many things in life you can't control. This is a way to reduce your risk of this cancer.
And the colonoscopy procedure, actually, the colonoscopist is able to remove any polyp that he or she finds. And consequently, this is one of the ways in which it's actually a preventive measure, as it were.
Right.
Not just a detective measure.
Okay, Tara, we need to run through these calls, but we can't take them. So we're going to interpret for Chris in Ithaca, New York, ulcerative colitis. What can Chris do besides Humira?
So ulcerative colitis is one of a group of diseases that are called inflammatory bowel diseases. These are chronic diseases of the bowel that are immunologically mediated, meaning that your own immune system is essentially causing inflammation in the bowels in concert to this thing we were talking about before, the microbiome. Humira is a very common treatment for these diseases, but far from the only treatment. There are very simple treatments, for instance, sulfasalazine, which is a treatment that's been around
longer. This goes
longer.
Back to when I was in graduate school.
But it turns out it's effective. So,
and cheap.
and cheap. So there are other options if either Humira is not working or if the caller is worried about being on it chronically. Talk to your doc. You have other options. There are multiple effective treatments for this disease.
A question from Carol in Naples, Florida. Gluten. How effective is removing gluten for GI problems, especially, of course, celiac? But what about other GI issues?
If a person has celiac disease, there are some gastrointestinal manifestations, and following a gluten-free diet is absolutely critical, maybe life-saving. But for other people?
Great question. So there are essentially three buckets of folks out there. People that can eat as much gluten as they want, it doesn't bother them. People who are what we call gluten sensitive, meaning that they don't have the actual celiac disease, which is the allergy to gluten, but clearly gluten is mediating some of their symptoms. And then there's finally the celiac group. The celiac group has to be on a gluten-free diet or else they're at risk for lots of problems. The gluten-sensitive group is interesting, and clearly they do better without. So it's a very reasonable thing to think about if you're having chronic upset to try at least for a while how you do on a gluten-free diet to see if you're one of those folks.
Dr. Shaheen, the question of the day, actually, you thought it was colonoscopy, but actually it is when. When do you take action for your digestive symptom?
It's a great question. And there are a couple of little tidbits that I will give your listeners. If you have what's called a warning symptom, meaning if you're experiencing weight loss, if you're experiencing dysphagia or difficulty swallowing, if you're experiencing odynophagia, which is pain on swallowing, you need to let your doc know about that. These are so-called alarm symptoms that should mandate early investigation. Chronic complaints like, oh gosh, I've got diarrhea again, and I've had this for 15 years after I eat X. That's probably something that, well, you might want to bring it up with your PCP, does not mandate a emergency or urgent.
And you might not want to eat X.
That would be good advice.
And if you have really bad pain, you better go see your doctor. That's all the time we have today. Thanks so much for listening and for calling in your stories. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Nicholas Shaheen, the Bozimski-Heiser Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and Chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at UNC. Dr. Shaheen is a recognized expert in esophageal diseases and endoscopy.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Pamela Alberta provided technical assistance. Jenny Lawson is our engineer.
The People's Pharmacy is produced at the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
The People's Pharmacy theme music is by B.J. Lederman.
To order today's show, you can call 800-732-2334. Today's show is 1,179, or find it on the web at peoplespharmacy.com.
And when you go to the site, you can tell us what you think about the show, sign up for our free online newsletter, or subscribe to the free podcast.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thanks for listening. Please join us again next week.